One thing that I did not bring up here that I don't know if the video showed mentioned it or not, but it is worthy of mention. That is that the Book of Ruth doesn't actually bring up God at all. But it's a unique book because the fact that you definitely see God working. And I think that one of the ways that the book is unique is because of the fact that it does not, because God's not mentioned in a direct way in the book. What you're seeing is really you're seeing the life of Ruth through the eyes of Ruth in many respects, and Naomi and Boaz, the way you and I would live life, which is we're not when we do talk to God, we pray, but we don't actually hear him say something, audibly most of the time, and so they when you read Ruth and Naomi and so on, particularly Naomi. Just you see them experience God and come to conclusions of what they think God is doing, which they find out later on that they're wrong. But that kind of makes the book a little bit unique. You see God working silently in the background. That's pretty unique. So now the book of Ruth is also unique because it is the only one of two books in Scripture whose main protagonist is a female. Though a case could be made for Song of Solomon's love being a co protagonist in that book. Contrary to popular thought, though, this is not due to some form of a slant against women in the Bible, native to Jewish culture. While it is true that God established the Jewish culture, and in fact the entire human race is patriarchal, that is not the reason for this novelty. The truth is that the Old Testament is a book of heritage and covenant. As such, it requires it to follow a bloodline. And that requires a patriarchal approach to the recording of the history. When women did interact with or greatly influence the development and direction of that heritage and covenant, they are mentioned without a hint of bigotry or censor. In fact, their contribution is celebrated. So, and this such is the situation with Ruth. Ruth is a real-life story of a Moabite woman who forsakes her pagan god and heritage to marry a Hebrew son of a woman named Naomi. We know of the Moabites from the fact that they were the descendants of Lot and his two daughters, and the fact that we encountered them along with the prophet Balaam back in Numbers chapter 10 and Numbers chapters 22 through 24. What makes Ruth special and sets her apart as an example is the fact that as a pagan foreigner, she exhibits fidelity and devotion to God in a time when the nation of Israel itself was largely unfaithful to God. God sees Ruth, and really that's nothing new for us because in the New Testament we're used to Jesus being amazed at the faith of Gentiles and amazed at the lack of faith of the Jews. So this isn't entirely a unique concept to us, but it is one of the first times you see it appearing in the Bible. God sees Ruth, he sees her faithfulness and love and rewards her and gives her and her posterity an inheritance in Israel and in the kingdom of God. God uses this foreign woman to save Naomi, who is convinced that God has cursed her, by arranging a meeting with Boaz, one of Naomi's late husband's closest kin, who is also a wealthy landowner and farmer in Judea. In doing so, God worked to orchestrate the redemption of Naomi and Ruth, as well as the family name of their late husbands, and placed her in a privileged position in the lineage of Jesus as the great-grandmother of King David. The story of Ruth is a beautiful depiction of God's sovereignty working together with human free will choices in order to affect his redemptive purposes in our lives. It teaches us the great value of honoring God's ways, honoring our mates even after death, and trusting God with our circumstances and our futures. In the end, Ruth's story also brings into clear focus God's redemptive love for all of humanity through the Redeemer found only in Jesus Christ, our faithful kinsman Redeemer. The author of the book is probably, that we don't know, is probably Samuel. And the time is, of course, the time of the judges, somewhere between 1250 and 1043 BC. So let's go ahead and start in chapter 1, verse 1. During the time of the judges, there's your clue of when this was happening. There was a famine in the land, and a man left Bethlehem in Judea with his wife and two sons to live in the land of Moab for a while. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name was Naomi. The name of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. these were Ephrathites of Bethlehem in Judea. An Ephrathite, of course, just is someone from the tribe of Ephraim. They entered the land of Moab and settled there. Naomi's husband Elimelech died, and she was left with her two sons. Her sons took Moabite women as their wives. One was named Orpah, and the second was named Ruth. After they lived in Moab about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two children and without her husband. She and her daughters-in-law prepared to leave the land of Moab because she had heard in Moab that the Lord had paid attention to his people's needs by providing them food, which of course was the reason why they left in the first place, because there was a plague, or not a plague, but a lack of food. So verse 7, she left the place where she had been living in Moab, accompanied by her two daughters-in-law, and traveled along the road leading back to the land of Judah. She said to them, "Each of you go back to your mother's home. May the Lord show faithful love to you as you have shown to the dead and to me," meaning to my husband and to your husbands, meaning when she talked about the dead, "and to me. May the Lord enable each of you to find security in the house of your new husband." She kissed them, and they wept loudly. Verse 10, "No," they said to her, we will go with you to your people." But Naomi replied, "Return home, my daughters. Why do you want to go with me? Am I able to have any more sons who can become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. Go on, for I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me to have a husband and to bear sons, would you be willing to wait for them to grow up? Would you restrain yourself from remarrying? No, my daughters, my life is much too bitter for you to share, because the Lord's hand has turned against me." This is something I did not mention in my notes, but I'll mention here. Again, it's something we lose in our very disconnected culture that we have in America. But in their culture and their time, and many cultures around the world, and it's true in some respect in America as well. When you marry, you don't marry just, you know, the mate, you marry the family. That's an obvious given. But especially for a woman, when she left her home, she was joined to the home of another. And even though she would visit her family, there were still relatives, her previous life was over. And so it was in both of these girls' minds to continue on with her. But the wording that Naomi uses here is very close akin to the word koinonia that we see in the New Testament, when she said, "No, my daughters, my life is too bitter for you to share." So the word sharing, to share a shared experience and a shared life. "My life is too bitter for you to koinonia with me, because the Lord has turned his hand against me." But I want you to notice that koinonia, a shared experience and a shared life, being rooted together and joined together at the hip, was a concept of marriage into the family of another. She was encouraging them to go off and try to find their own life and break the koinonia that they had with Naomi. Verse 14, "And again they wept loudly, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Naomi said, 'Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her God. Follow your sister-in-law.' But Ruth replied, 'Do not persuade me to leave you or to go back and not follow you. For wherever you go, I will go, and wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do this to me, and even more, if anything but death separates you and me.' When Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped trying to persuade her." Now, I want you to notice here as well, this is one of the reasons why God blessed Ruth, because the fact that she, not just because of her devotion to Naomi, which was commendable, but she said out of her own mouth, "Your God will be my God." And she made good on that by the way that she acted in her life. So here we see Naomi's conclusion regarding her circumstance. Like I told you before, God's not brought up directly in the book as a main character in the book. He's brought up peripherally as someone who does things. And Naomi, so that's one of the things that makes you Ruth unique, because Naomi is coming to her own conclusions about what's happening here. And we can ask ourselves how many of us, as God's people and children, make the unwarranted assumption that God has turned his hand against us, or at very least has forgotten us or left us to ourselves. But Naomi sees the loss in her life, which admittedly has been great, as God's hand against her for evil, which is one of the reasons why she didn't want her daughters-in-law to partake of that evil by being a shared experience with her. She wanted them to go on with their own life and even, you know, evoke God's blessing on them. Yet she still speaks well of God by evoking a blessing on her daughters-in-law of God's faithful love in establishing their lives back in Moab with new husbands and security with safety. So Naomi still believed in the goodness of God, and she believed that God was a God that could still be prayed to and he would show faithful love. But in her own mind, because of her circumstances, she determined that God's hand had turned against her. And this is one of the things that makes this book a beautiful book, because it's one we can identify with. When bad situations happen in our life, the typical response is, why God? That's essentially what Naomi's going on, addressing in her life. Neither of the daughters wanted to leave Naomi. This says a lot about Naomi. They are both willing to return with her to her homeland rather than stay in Moab, the place of their birth. In the end, Orpah does give in to Naomi's request, but Ruth would rather die than leave her. Whether this is just out of love for Naomi or out of respect to her late husband and watching out for his mother, no one can truly know, but faithfulness seems to play a part because of the rewards that God winds up giving her as a result. But I can't stress enough that something... There's clearly something in the character of Naomi that makes these women willing to, and at least at the beginning, even Orpah nearly fights to stay with her, and to commit their life to her. So I think that is worthy of note, that Naomi was clearly a good and a godly woman. So let's pick up in verse 19. The two of them traveled until they came to Bethlehem. When they entered Bethlehem, the whole town was excited about their arrival, and the local women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara," she said, "for the Almighty has made me very bitter. I left full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has pronounced judgment on me, and the Almighty has afflicted me?" So Naomi came back from the land of Moab with her daughter-in-law Ruth, the Moabitess. They arrived in Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Now, Naomi had a relative on her husband's side named Boaz. He was a prominent man of noble character from Elimelech's family. That was Naomi's husband. Ruth and Moabitess asked Naomi, "Will you let me go out into the fields and gather fallen grain behind someone who allows me to do it?" And Naomi answered her, "Go ahead, my daughter." Now, let's just stop right there. Again, we see faithfulness on Ruth's part, as well as respect for her mother-in-law. Respect for asking permission rather than just doing it, and faithfulness in seeking to provide for both of them. Ruth is clearly just a gem of a woman. In Israel, as we have learned, the gleaning of the fields was left behind for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, right? So this is what Ruth was seeking to do. She wanted permission from Naomi to go back behind the people that are out in the field gleaning it, and to go out there and gather. Now, if you remember, in Deuteronomy 24, verse 19, it said, "When you reap the harvest in your field, and you forget a sheaf in the field, you are not to go back to get it. It is to be left for the foreign resident, for the fatherless, and the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands." So that's, you couldn't get a more textbook definition of what Ruth was asking to do. "I want to go behind those harvesting, and whatever they drop or whatever they fail to grab in the first run through the field, that belonged to the foreign resident, the fatherless, and the widow. And Ruth fit two of those descriptions. She was a widow and she was a foreign resident. So pick up back in verse 3. And again, that reference that I gave you was in Deuteronomy 24, verse 19. Now pick up at verse 3 in chapter 2 of Ruth. So Ruth left and entered the field to gather grain behind the harvesters. She happened to be in the portion of the land belonging to Boaz, who was the Elimelech from Elimelech's family. Again, you see the phrase, she happened to be. It just so happened. Even the writer of this book, which we believe was probably Samuel, it kind of is hinting to the idea that God kind of orchestrated that. She might have thought it was something she did of her own free will, but God kind of directed her, and she wound up right where she needed to be when she needed to be there, which is something I've taught you guys on and off for years and years and years and years. That, you know, we waste a lot of our time wondering with the what ifs in our head. What if I'd made this decision? What if I'd turned to the Lord earlier? What if I'd done this? And what if I'd done that? And those aren't bad questions, because I'm not saying that it would not affect the outcome of our story to some degree. I mean, certainly if we started following the Lord earlier in life, it would affect our lives. But, you know, if we are in love with the Lord and at least trying to pursue Him as best as we understand how, we have seen way too many stories already since Genesis to know that God winds up in His sovereignty somehow orchestrating events so that we are exactly where we need to be when we need to be there. And again, I think the greatest example was Moses. He killed the Egyptian. He runs off away from him, into another land, and winds up taking care of sheep for 40 years, and he just so happens to run into the fiery bush, and God speaks to him, and he was right at the right place where he needed to be at the right time. And when all that ended, so that when Moses led Israel out of Egypt, it says that they went out on the day that God had orchestrated over 400 plus years earlier in his prophecy. So there you have it. You know, a guy that largely screwed up and didn't know what he was doing and felt like his life was a bit of a wash, and God orchestrated everything so that he was right where he needed to be when he needed to be there. And that's what I believe happened here. So in verse 4, later when Boaz arrived from Bethlehem, he said to the harvesters, "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they replied. Boaz asked his servant who was in charge of the harvesters, "Whose young woman is this?" Now, one of the reasons why that she would have been singled out, because there would have been a lot of women out in the field, widows who were gathering. And again, let's just go ahead and throw that out there too. I don't know if I mentioned it later in my notes, but God expected the women to go out there and get their own dang food. You know, if you're a widow, now, of course, if you were old and you couldn't do it, there was compensation that was made for them. But if you were able-bodied and you were a widow, you went out there and got your own food. It was left for you, but you went and you got it. So there would have, the field would have been filled with that kind of thing. But because they had recently been in a bit of a blight, they probably didn't have too many strangers there. They would have mostly probably been Israelites. And so this young Moabite woman would have kind of stood out among the rest of them. That's probably why he asked. So he asked, "Whose young woman is this?" Verse 6. The servant answered, "She is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab. She asked, 'Will you let me gather fallen grain from the bundles behind the harvesters?' She came and has remained from early morning until now, except she rested for a little while in a shelter." Now, notice the question reveals the covering, which was a God-ordained truth in Israel. Boaz wanted to know whose young girl this was, meaning, who does she belong to? Who's her covering? The question was ultimately wanting to know, what household is she attached to? Who's her father? Who did she marry? Who's her husband? And of course, the answer now was, of course, she's a foreign widow who's living with Naomi. And so in that respect, she was a woman without a cover, without a covering. And that is what, at this point, to the rest of the story, Boaz begins to seek to, and God begins to orchestrate to provide. So now we're going to start in verse 8 again, chapter 2. Then Boaz said to Ruth, so, I mean, we're kind of skipping on ahead because he was in, just a moment ago, he was in the field, and he obviously leaves the field, seeks out, or seeks Ruth in the field, and he says, listen, my daughter, don't go and gather grain in another field, and don't leave this one, but stay here close to my young women. See which field they are harvesting in and follow them. You haven't I ordered the young men not to touch you? When you are thirsty, go and drink from the jars that the young man have filled. So she bowed with her face down to the ground and said to him, why are you so kind to notice me, although I am a foreigner? And Boaz answered her, everything you have done for your mother-in-law since your husband's death has been fully reported to me. How you have left your father and mother and the land of your birth, and how you came to a people you did not previously know. May the Lord reward you for what you have done, and may you receive a full reward from the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. So you can see Boaz immediately, after he had asked whose young woman is this, he was given a full answer and he found out who this was. And Boaz knew he was related to Naomi. So he immediately saw, this is part of my responsibility to watch out for this girl. Not because of her specifically as much as because she belongs with Naomi at the moment. So, and notice also the respect that Ruth has for him. So picking up at verse 13, she says, my Lord, which was a term of honor and respect. It doesn't mean Lord as we use it for God. It was almost like we use the word sir, only a little bit more respect given as a title. So, my Lord, she said, you have been so kind to me, for you have comforted and encouraged your slave, although I am not like one of your other female servants. Now, again, notice there, she's going even further, and this is kind of a sing-song relationship you see happening throughout this book of constantly deferring to the other person. Even Boaz deferring to Naomi, and even Boaz deferring to Ruth, they're constantly, if you can take it like that, they're almost like bowing to one another as they speak, showing honor and deference towards one another. And she even calls herself his servant, his slave. In verse 14, at mealtime, Boaz told her, come over here and have some bread and dip it here in the vinegar sauce. So she came and sat beside the harvesters, and he offered her roasted grain. She ate and was satisfied and had some left over. When she got up to gather the grain, Boaz ordered his young men, be sure to let her gather grain among the bundles and don't humiliate her. Pull out some stalks from the bundles for her and leave them behind for her to gather. Do not rebuke her. So Ruth gathered grain in the field until evening. She beat out what she had gathered, and it was about 26 quarts of barley. She picked up the grain and went to the city where her mother-in-law saw that where her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. Then she brought out what she had left over from her meal and gave it to her. Now, I want you to notice as well here, before we go to verse 19, Boaz orders barley to be deliberately left behind. God's command was, whatever you drop or leave behind by accident, that is left for the foreigner, for the stranger, the widow, and the fatherless. And Boaz is going a step further and says, I don't want her to be humiliated. So what I want you to do is accidentally, without her realizing what's happening, accidentally on purpose, leave some barley fall behind you for Ruth to gather so that she'll have enough without feeling pitied. You notice the careful love and consideration Boaz was having for her. She would have had enough to eat if the regular process had followed its normal course, but he wanted extra given to her. So he said, you know, make it look like an accident. You're dropping barley behind you so that she's not humiliated and she doesn't feel pitied and she's able to gather up a good portion. Notice also that Boaz did not order the young man to gather it for her. She needed to do the work. He was only making sure that her labors paid off well. Ruth threshed her own barley. That wasn't done for her either. All of this speaks kind of like to the Proverbs 31 woman. It says she rises early in the morning, which is more of a metaphor than it's an actual literal fact. But it means that she works hard with her hands all day long. She knows what it is to work with her hands and to break a sweat. This is a profitable woman. This is a woman who is a helpmate for her husband. And it's a good character trait for a woman. And so Ruth threshed her own barley, separating the grain, gathering it, and brought it back to her mother-in-law. Just so you know, that amounted to about 30 pounds, U.S. pounds. So, 1 pound of flour, you and I both know, goes a long way. One day of work, she brought back 30 pounds. That's quite a bit, just in one day's labor. Now we're picking up in verse 19. Then her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you gather barley today, and where did you work? May the Lord bless the man who noticed you." Again, notice the deference. Immediately, Naomi makes the assumption that a man in Israel noticed her. So it points back to the patriarchal nature of the way society worked back then. But you notice it's not against women. It's for them. And the proof was she automatically assumed that a man paid attention because she had so much, not just that she had something, but she had so much. And Ruth told her mother-in-law about the men she had worked with and said, the name of the man I worked with today is Boaz. Then Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord who has not forsaken his kindness to the living or the dead." Naomi continued, The man is a close relative. He is one of our family redeemers. Ruth the Moabite said, he also told me, stay with my young men until they've finished all my harvesting. So Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, Ruth, my daughter, this is good for you to work with this with his young men so that nothing will happen to you in another field. See, again, Boaz was watching out for her. He knew that if she went to another field, any number of things could have happened. But this was his way of being able to watch over her. Ruth stayed close to Boaz's young women and gathered grain until the barley and the wheat harvests were finished. And she lived there with her mother-in-law. So now these two harvests here extended for a long period of time. This wasn't just a short employment. These corresponded to the feasts in Israel as well. The barley harvest was the first grain harvest of the year, immediately followed by the wheat harvest. The barley harvest is a warmer climate harvest and corresponds to Passover and first fruits. In fact, the barley itself is the first fruits that is offered. Then the wheat harvest was in late spring and corresponded to the Feast of Weeks, which you and I call Pentecost, which is 50 days after Passover. So she was with him working in the field for at least 40 to 45 days, maybe the whole 50 days. So this was not, again, a short employment. She was there for a few months doing this. Now we're in chapter 3, starting in verse 1. Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, said to her, "My daughter, shouldn't I find security for you so that you will be taken care of?" Again, we see the role of a male as the covering for a female, both as provider, a lover, and a heritage, a larger story to live in. And verse 2, continuing, Now is Boaz our relative? Haven't you been working with his young women? This evening he will be winnowing barley in the threshing floor. Wash, put on perfumed oil, and wear your best clothes. Go down to the threshing floor, but do not let the man know that you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, notice the place where he is lying. Go and uncover his feet and lie down. Then he will explain to you what you should do. So Ruth said, "I will do everything that you say." Again, this is a beautiful depiction of honor and trust and walking in the design of God for your life. Naomi was offering both cultural and common sense advice. She needed to get Ruth in a position to be noticed and to make a straightforward but honest request to Boaz. To do this, she needed to pretty herself up. There's nothing wrong with a woman making herself attractive for a man that she desires to marry. In most cases, nothing comes more natural to a woman than this. Notice, though, that this was not in an attempt to manipulate Boaz, only so that he, that once she was noticed, to tilt the scales in her favor of being favorably noticed. So it was not intended to manipulate. It was just, you know, get yourself gussied up, look good when you go, and then place yourself before him. He's going to notice you, but by you dressing up and smelling good and looking good, he might notice you more favorably than if you'd gone, straight sweaty from the field. So also you know that Boaz was an older man and Naomi was a younger woman. This is perfectly normal throughout history, including today in many cultures. And in fact, I was just reading an article the other day where it talked about that there's been a real resurgence in younger women gravitating towards older men, globally around the world. Naomi knew that Boaz might want to redeem Ruth, but might also have been a little reluctant due to his age, yet because he was much more advanced in years than would have been considered normal. Yet by Ruth getting her cleaned up and gussied up for him, it might relieve any inhibitions he might have had. So as for uncovering his feet and laying down by or below them, this was a cultural representation of total submission. She was showing herself, and she said it earlier. She said, she called herself Boaz's slave. And by taking this position beneath his feet after uncovering his feet, it was a cultural representation of total submission. In other words, she was essentially following through on her word of saying, "I've assumed the role of a slave, and whatever you say, whatever your word is concerning me, that's going to be what happens for me." Now we cannot lose sight that in the culture of that day, this was understood as an act of total submission. We should not lose sight also of the intentions behind Naomi's instructions. In Jewish culture, the right of the kinsman redeemer was a right that women had, one that needed to be claimed. It didn't just happen. And so she was presenting herself to claim this right or to at least request it. As best as Naomi knew, Boaz was the closest kin, and therefore this was not only proper, but her legal right. Ruth had the right to expect Boaz to marry her and to attempt to impregnate her to raise a child to her husband Elimelech's, to her husband's name. And also, in a way, it would also affect Elimelech's name because it would bend his posterity. At least for the firstborn of that union would have been for Ruth's dead husband. Ruth was being counseled to come to obtain her right, but to do it in an attitude of a servant with humility, thus laying herself at the feet. She could have just walked up to him and said, "You know what? This is the situation. I want you to play the role of the kinsman redeemer. I'm asking you if you'll do that." And that would not have been inappropriate in Israel, even for a woman to address a man like that. But by doing it the way she did it, it showed humility. And I think that was a fitting thing to do. Ruth was being counseled to come to obtain her right, but to do it in the attitude of a servant. Her actions would have been spoken respect to Boaz, actually. A respect which showed abandonment in trust to the kindness of this man. So far as they knew, Ruth and Naomi's futures were in the hand of Boaz. Even though it was expected and culturally respected to play the role of kinsman redeemer, it was not required. It had to be voluntary. So that's another reason why it was wise for Naomi to come in more of a capitulating way rather than coming in, you know, guns blazing. So, so now we're going to pick up back in verse 6, and we see the obedience of Ruth to Naomi. She went down to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law had instructed her. After Boaz ate, drank, and was in good spirits, he went to lay down at the end of the pile of barley. Then she went in secretly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. At midnight, Boaz was startled, turned over, and there, lying at his feet, was a woman. So he asked, "Who are you?" "I am Ruth, your slave," she replied. "Spread your cloak over me, for you are a family redeemer." Now, here is perhaps one of the clearest pictures of a covering being used. It is being used here both symbolically and in a literal way. She's saying, "I want you to cover me with your cloak," which essentially just means bring me underneath your roof, bring me under your household because you're my family redeemer. So, but that's one of the reasons why we get the terminology of a covering. You also see that same word in the New Testament where Paul said that a woman in their day needed, well, in every day, they need to have a symbol of authority on their head when they come to church. But in their day, one of the symbols of authority was to have their head covered. And that was both also literal and symbolic of having a covering, being underneath some male authority. So verse 10, then he said, may the Lord bless you, my daughter. You have shown more kindness now than before because you have not pursued younger men, whether rich or poor. Now, don't be afraid, my daughter. I will do for you whatever you say, since all the people in my town know that you are a woman of noble character. Yes, it is true that I am a family, redeemer, but there is a redeemer closer than I am. Stay here tonight and in the morning. If he wants to redeem you, that's good. Let him redeem you. But if he does not want to redeem you, as the Lord lives, I will. Now lie down until morning. So she lay down at his feet until morning, but got up while it was still dark. Then Boaz said, don't let it be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. And he told Ruth, bring the shawl you are wearing and hold it out. When she held it out, he shoveled 6 measures of barley into her shawl. And that's kind of an interesting thing there, because that shows how far back this goes. If you remember, the Bible talks about that if you... give, it'll be given back to you. Good measure, running over shall men give into your bosom. What that was a reference to was they would often, the women would go to the marketplace and they'd be wearing an outer garment. They would hold up their outer garment. It wouldn't reveal anything, of course, because it was the outer garment. And that is what they would fill the flour in the marketplace with. And, The promise of God was, if you're a person that is a giver, then when people give to you, they will give good measure, pressed down, shaking together, and run over. Well, you know that that how many times you buy something in the store and it says that settling takes place, which is why there's like this much air in a box that big. well, what they would do is they would shovel stuff into that garment, and then they'd allow them to shake it to get the air out, and then they would put more in, and they'd allow them to shake it, and then keep on doing that, and then they would press it down to get all the air out, and to the point where it was overflowing. That was considered good measure. Well, that's what was happening here. I don't know about the good measure part, but at least it was happening as being put into her outer garment like that. So he told Ruth, bring the shawl that you're wearing and hold it out. And when she held it out, he shoveled 6 measures of barley into her shawl, and she went to the city. Again, I keep on interrupting, but it's important to know this as well. Again, you see the heart of God reflected in the Jewish heart, because she just, she had taken home the first day. She took home over 30 pounds, and she has regularly gone to the field for God knows how many days now, maybe a couple of months, gathering flour or wheat every day. So, I mean, these people are not hurting for wheat, and yet he won't let her leave empty-handed. It's just another sign of the way God expects God's people to be. He expects his people to always, don't send, that's part of what the Bible talks about, of being given to hospitality and being hospitable people. People in the body of Christ should be known for their giving. They always are. They don't send you home empty-handed, and that's exactly what's taking place here. Then Ruth told her, she went back to her mother-in-law, Naomi, who asked her, how did it go, my daughter? Then Ruth told her everything that the man had done for her. Verse 17, she said, he gave me these 6 measures of barley because he said, do not go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. Wait, my daughter, she said, until you find out how things go, for he will not rest until he resolves this today. So again, this is an amazing section of scripture. We have confirmed for us again that Boaz was an older man, and he considered this appeal as being honored by this young woman, because she could have, in fact, like he said, attempted to allure a younger man who might have also been rich, but she sought out the favor of this older man. Though the book never says so, there are several allusions to her being an attractive woman. Naomi wants to protect her from the younger men, as did Boaz, something which probably would not have been as much of a concern if she had been kind of homely or unattractive. Boaz is an honorable man. He did not have to tell her that another kinsman redeemer was first in line. He could have proceeded and feigned ignorance if it later came to light, but he did what was right from the onset. He also sought to protect her image by setting her home at night. And it was an image worth protecting, for even as a foreigner, Boaz said that she was well-liked and viewed as an honorable woman. That is really, really saying something, because Jewish people, by and large, you remember how all the cleanly laws, you know, clean and unclean and all the different things that God did to kind of create a stigma in the Jewish mind to stay away from foreigners. And that was largely to keep them away from their gods. But it also affected them in being kind of uppity around other people of other ethnicities outside of Jewish circles. And so for her to have come in among them and in literally just a few months have a kind of reputation like this was really, it's a testimony to Ruth. She was obviously an amazing woman. Also notice the way things were done in Israel. I kind of mentioned this part already, that he wouldn't let her go home empty-handed. This entire story shows provision from every angle, as well as God's supervision and oversight in guiding the entire process behind the scenes. He steers everything towards his desired end, which is blessing. Far from being invisible to God or even worse, cursed by him, Naomi was actually tenderly loved by God. And even though he was misunderstood by her, he still sought only her good. And that's what the story continues to bear out. Finally, notice the relational trust Naomi has in Boaz. Not only did she believe in his character enough to attempt this whole thing in the first place, and she tells Ruth that Boaz is of such a character that he will not rest until Ruth's request can be properly answered. This whole book just screams honor and integrity by all three major players, by Naomi, Ruth, and by Boaz. Now, going to verse 5, this is the right... I'm actually skipping to the... I don't remember it's Numbers or Deuteronomy. I'll have the link on the website or the connection on the website. I'm just going to read to you the right of the kinsman redeemer real quickly. It says, I don't remember the reference, so forgive me on that, but I'm reading something you don't have in front of you. This is the right of the kinsman redeemer. It says, when brothers live on the same property and one of them dies without a son, the wife of the dead man may not marry a stranger outside the family. Her brother-in-law is to take her as his wife, have sexual relations with her, and perform the duty of a brother-in-law for her. The first son she bears will carry on the name of the dead brother, so his name will not be blotted out from Israel. But if the man does not want to marry his sister-in-law, she must go to the elders at the city gate and say, my brother-in-law refuses to preserve his brother's name in Israel. He isn't willing to perform the duty of a brother-in-law for me. The elders of this city will summon him and speak with him. If he persists and says, I do not want to marry her, then his sister-in-law will go up to him in the sight of the elders, remove his sandal from his foot, and spit on his face, and then she will declare, this is what is done to a man who will not build up his brother's house. And his family name in Israel will be called the house of the man whose sandal was removed. Now, that has a stigma attached to it that makes no sense to us, and I'll address it in a little bit. But I wanted to read that because what's happening here is instead of Ruth going to the city gate as a foreigner, Boaz takes it upon himself to go to the elders himself. She went to Boaz. Boaz is going to the elders. If this was following the strict letter of the law, which wasn't necessary, but if they go by the letter of law, she would have had to go before the elders. But again, I'm not sure that she had a right to appear before the elders as a foreigner. So Boaz may have needed to do this, but one way or the other, he did it. So now we're in chapter 4, verse 1. Boaz went to the gate of the town and sat down there. Soon, the family redeemer Boaz had spoken about came by. Boaz called him by name and said, come over here and sit down. So he went over there and sat down. Then Boaz took 10 men of the city's elders and said, sit here. And they sat down. And he said to the redeemer, Naomi, who has returned from the land of Moab, is selling a piece of land that belongs to our brother Elimelech. I thought I should inform you. buy it back in the presence of those seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you want to redeem it, do so. But if you do not want to redeem it, tell me so that I will know, because there isn't anyone other than you to redeem it. And I am next after you. I want to redeem it, he said. Then Boaz said, on the day you buy the land from Naomi, you will also acquire Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the deceased man, to perpetuate the man's name on his property. The redeemer replied, I can't redeem it myself, or it will ruin my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption, because I can't redeem it. Now, if you remember, a woman was only allowed to own land if there was no male heir to carry it, at which point she was, if she was young enough to seek out a mate, she was restricted in her choices to the tribe of her late husband in order to for the land to never leave that tribe, which makes a lot of sense now that we're in the Promised Land. You've seen the land allotted, given by Lot. It can't leave that tribe. Here, Naomi's land is being redeemed by a kinsman, but it is only because no official proceedings had yet taken place to transfer the ownership away from her, and in fact, no such transfer could take place until a redeemer could be found, because there was no man in the household. You see, Naomi's husband died in Moab before her sons did, which if they had been in Israel, the land would have naturally transferred in ownership to them. But since they also died in Moab, no such transfer ever took place. If all had followed normal proceedings, the land would be Ruth's and Orpah's, because their husbands would have received the inheritance at the death of their father, and it would have fallen to their wives at their death. But here we are in the land, still essentially in Naomi's name by default. Attached to the land was Ruth, since all actually belonged to her late son, meaning Naomi's late son. Because remember, the father had died and all belonged to the son. So to purchase the land was also the assumed right of the kinsman redeemer. Notice also that it was Naomi's right to sell it rather than maintain ownership. Again, this is an example of God's provision for his daughters. This nearest of kin was willing to purchase the land, but not to take Ruth, since it would financially ruin him. This might seem confusing, even though I addressed it way back when we were in another book and we had talked about the kinsman redeemer. But it's most probable that the man was telling the truth. It would have ruined him financially. You see, if this man was already married and he had to purchase this land and receive another wife, he would have had to support her and any children born from that union separately from his current wife. So he would have been having to support two households. The original proposition was just buy land. Well, okay, well, great. That's just increasing my inheritance for my children. But when you throw in the wife to boot, now I've got two households to support, and I'm going to ruin my current inheritance. I won't be able to carry all that weight over the long haul. So that being the case, it seems like it was not a dishonor to fail to redeem her, because it wasn't just something he just chose, I don't want to do. It was because in doing it, he would have ruined his own family. And so it was not a shame for him to not follow through. Beyond that, there was knowledge that she would be cared for, since it would not fail to be done, since Boaz was not only available, but he had already stated that he was willing. So it was not a shame for this man to not follow through. Now in verse 7 says, at an earlier point in Israel, a man removed his sandal and gave it to another party in order to make any matter legally binding concerning the right of redemption or the exchange of property. This was the method of legally binding a transaction in Israel. So the redeemer removed his sandal and said to Boaz, buy back the property yourself. Now, according to Keelan, a guy's name I can't pronounce, it's something, it's Deutsch, their commentators, they said about this procedure, taking off the shoe. They said taking off the shoe was an ancient custom in Israel. The usage arose from the fact that when anyone took possession of landed property, he did so by treading upon the soil and asserting his right of possession by standing on it in his shoes. In this way, taking off the shoe and handing it to another person became a symbol of the renunciation of a man's possession and property. The custom was one of public disgrace in such a case as this with the kinsman redeemer, when the shoe was publicly taken off the foot of the brother-in-law by the widow who he refused to marry. So that's where all that kind of came in. So now, many times a rejection to pay the role of the kinsman redeemer was, like I said, a shame, and the woman would have had the right, and in fact, she would have just done this. She would have taken the shoe off of him and cast it before the council and spit in his face with those words. Interesting also, spitting upon another person, especially in the face, has always been a global sign of anger, hatred, disrespect, or contempt. This was her right as a woman in Israel, and her duty. Her right for her own dignity, having been refused care and a future, and her duty to her deceased husband, who was also being denied a male offspring to perpetuate his name in Israel. So it not only was her right, but it was also her duty. Now in verse 9, Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses today that I am buying from Naomi everything that belonged to Elimelech, Kilon, and Mahlon. I will also acquire Ruth the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, to perpetuate the deceased man's name on his property, so that his name will not disappear among his relatives or from the gates of his home. You are witnesses today." The elders and all the people who were at the gate said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is entering your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built the house of Israel. May you be powerful in Ephrath and famous in Bethlehem. May your house become like the house of Perez, the son of Tamar, bore to Judah, because of the offspring the Lord will give you by this young woman." Now, this lineage of Perez was well known to Boaz because it was his own, and you will see that in a moment as we finish reading the chapter. The crux of their blessing over Boaz and Ruth was essentially that their union would be blessed with children for many generations. So picking up in verse 13, "Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When he was intimate with her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. Then the woman said to Naomi, 'Praise the Lord, who has not left you without a family redeemer today. May his name be famous in Israel,'" meaning the son of their union of Boaz and Ruth. "May his name be famous in Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age." This is Ruth talking to Naomi. "Indeed, your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." And actually, I don't know if this was actually Ruth talking or the women of the city, but nonetheless, it was talking about the offspring. So you can see there, this is another example of where it fell to the son to sustain the widowed mother in her old age. This is where that's found in scripture. So that's what it was essentially saying there. "Praise the Lord, who has not left you, Naomi, without family redeemer today. May the name of this boy who's been born in Israel be famous. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age." So going to verse 16, "Naomi took the child, placed him on her lap, and took care of him. The neighbor women said, 'A son has been born to Naomi.'" Now, I know you and I both know that this was actually born to Ruth and was carrying on the family name of her husband, but this is all kind of considered one thing because it's a family. "And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David." Now, this is the genealogy of Perez, the guy we mentioned earlier. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram, who fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nahshon, who fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz, who fathered Obed. And Obed fathered Jesse, who fathered David. And that is what placed her in that lineage. So there you have it. There's the book of Ruth. Very, very short book, but again, I think it's awesome because it shows just great character. It shows all the things we learned in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, the laws for living lived out in story form, and it shows the deference and the honor with which the people of God honor each other. It to me, it completely silences all of the accusations of the modern world where people say, well, I don't read the Bible because it's hopelessly patriarchal. And it is patriarchal, like I said earlier. But the reason it's patriarchal is because it's a book of bloodline and heritage. So therefore, it had to be patriarchal. But by patriarchal, it does not mean it's against women. And you see how they were honored and put in a position of privilege. And so again, the last thing, again, just to recap that, you see God orchestrating everything silently in the background. He's not in the forefront. He's not making declarations through prophets. He's just kind of weaving in and out of their life. And the beautiful thing is that he's a silent partner, verbally speaking, but he's working together for Naomi's good, for the blessing of Ruth and for the blessing of Boaz and for the blessing of these three men who had passed away. God honors all of them. And I think it's a beautiful picture of God and how he works. So